Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have the pleasure of talking to T.C. Boyle, Tom Boyle. His publisher, Viking, has put out the second volume of his collected stories under the title Stories 2, and now we see it. After all these many years, there's nearly 2,000 pages of stories, yes, and there are more stories, say, than John Cheever or Eudora Welty, perhaps more than Chekhov. What is
this? Michael, thank you so much. Nice company to be in, I suppose.
Yes, what does this mean to you?
What it means is that I'm a hyperactive man whose mind is never at rest, and stories just come erupting out of me. I don't feel good unless I'm making a story, whether it's a novel or a short piece, as these are.
On the cover, there's a picture of T.C. Boyle looking as T.C. Boyle has always looked, tall, skinny, piercing eyes, reddish hair, a very good T-shirt, a magnificent red sports jacket on the spine, a different T-shirt, and a yellow sports jacket. And I think in a certain way that perfecting your look has been as much a project as perfecting a short story.
Oh, shucks, Michael. You know, some of us writers are also models for GQ. We can't help it. You know, we're graced with this. No, actually, I sort of am what I am. One of my students, I've been teaching at USC for 35 years, came in, and the office is exactly the same crap hanging on the wall, et cetera. Maybe he'd graduated 10 years before, and he said, never change. And of course, I do agree with the great American philosopher Woody Allen, who in one of his movies was accused by the wife of being afraid of change. And he said, yes, change equals death.
And yet the stories are also about the obligation to change, or how if you're not ready and flexible and pliable, change will get you.
Well, of course, to step back a moment, in this volume, I've written a preface and sort of apologia pro vita sua, and look back over my career, why I'm doing it, what it means. And of course, if I look back from the first volume to this one, perhaps these stories were more whimsical, or there was a higher percentage of the whimsical, absurdist stories in the earlier ones, which, you know, began with the first stories I had ever written. And perhaps there's a larger percentage of more dramatic ones or ones that are more character-oriented. But still, it's this tremendous range and mix that interests me. I don't want to be predictable. I don't want to write the same sort of thing over and over. I want always to be looking forward and find out what the world is like. That's why I write stories. What obsesses me, especially things that have to do with the environment or all these electronic inventions that control our lives. Why? You know, this is actually, that's the essence of stories for me, is here's a situation. Well, why is it?
Well, I think also you let the story take you to new places now. I once detected a formula, which was that there was an outsider, a b-boy, a monster of one kind or another, whose behavior outraged adults and civil society. Because they rejected him, his behavior would become worse and worse. Read Beastings galore. And even though that boy was intolerable, really a menace to the community, the people who rejected him were punished because the message of the story was welcome the stranger, embrace the monster. But now I think if T.C. Boyle is growing up, It's that sometimes the monster is monstrous. Sometimes it's impossible to embrace the stranger, or the results are more ambiguous than they used to be, and therefore it seems to me necessarily less whimsical.
All right. Well said. My God. Well, of course, I'm also concerned a lot about this dichotomy between our animal selves and our intellectual or spiritual selves. And so, for instance, the title story of one of the collections
that
is wrapped into this, Tooth and Claw or Wild Child, in which I retold the story of the Wild Child of Aveyron, which had been made into a movie by Truffaut many thousands of years ago, which I'd seen in its period, but purposely did not review because I wanted to have my own take on this material. What is it like? What is it like to, what would it be like to live without language and without any kind of society? So I think you'll find many stories in here that that deal with that sort of situation.
But were you yourself the wild child or the b-boy? I mean, these are the characters I think you identify with very deeply.
I think it's easiest for me, obviously, through the novels and these short stories, to write a kind of outsider punk point of view. That kind of character comes easy to me, like William Peck Wilson, the bad guy of Talk Talk, for instance. But you can't do always what's easiest for you. Otherwise, you get stuck in a rut and you're not a good artist. So that, for instance, the last novel, San Miguel, is entirely from the point of view of women. And it's rather static. They're trapped on this island. Can I do that?
I was telling someone that T.C. Boyle is very paradoxical. On the one hand, he's the consummate pro. He stayed with the same publisher from his first book on, and yet his subject matter is the difficulty that the rebel and the outcast have in finding a place, in finding a place where they can be.
Well, sometimes you get lucky and you find a place where you can be. As at USC, for instance, as with my wife, whom I've been with most of my life, there is something that speaks strongly to me with regard to a kind of loyalty in a community. In the face of the chaos of the world, I need something substantial or something to rely on, and then I can let my mind go free. And again, I've never written anything for a purpose to make money or on assignment or anything else. I've been very lucky to be able to simply be an artist in the way of my friend Pablo Campos, who lives here in L.A., the painter. He just paints, and I just make stories. I've never had to compromise.
I'm talking to T.C. Boyle about his stories, too. Wonderful. Huge. Let's see. Well, over 900 pages of stories. And I seem to notice now, as I didn't before, there are many mouse holes where the stories might have taken different directions. You build them so that you have mobility. Afterwards, they look perfectly constructed, as if they were always going where they went. But the rereader can see how many directions you've built in.
You know, that's a good observation.
What interests me is that sometimes these stories become a perfect formulation of your concerns and themes. I think in particular, but I'm going to have a terribly hard time pronouncing it, Chicxulub?
Chicxulub.
Yes. And that's an example of a story where anything could have happened. It looks so predetermined. We're being told about a meteor that can break through our atmosphere and end the dinosaur age.
Mm-hmm. This, of course, as you know, is one of my favorite stories to present to an audience. It rivets them. It horrifies them. And there's a great power and feeling in that. How does this story evolve? I had been interested in these end of civilization events, as they're called. A meteor like the Chicxulub one, if it hit, that's the end of our civilization and everything we have. I then paralleled this with just a human story of parents being called in the night that their teenage daughter has been hit by a drunken driver, is in the hospital, quite possibly dying in extremely critical condition. And so the two play off each other, the cosmic and the real moments of our lives that are so dramatic and powerful for us alone. You know, you read of 6 dead and 80 wounded. It doesn't mean anything to us unless it affects us directly. So here we have the cosmic on one hand alternating with this very dramatic story of parents having to go in the middle of the night to the hospital in the rain like penitents to find out if their daughter is alive.
Dickens loved to read the murder of Nancy from Oliver Twist.
Yes.
And when he'd read it, women in particular, but people assembled would faint, and he would feel very proud of himself as a writer. He liked having an effect, a powerful effect.
The power of a story. This is why I like to perform so often, comic stories, but also dramatic ones. And of course, as you know, in the introduction here, I mention an anecdote about that very story, Chicxulub. When I was first on tour with that book, I'd just begun to read it. It was a bookshop in Miami. There were probably only 50 people. It was dark, intimate atmosphere. And I began to read the story. One third of the way through, a woman began to sob. She had been there. This had happened to her. And I wanted to stop and say, it's only fiction. But in fact, she owned that story. She had lived it, and I hadn't. It's a game to me. To her, it was her tragedy of her life.
I wanted to ask you to read the opening from Chicxulub. This is T.C. Boyle reading one of those stories, I have to say it, that grabs you by the throat.
My daughter is walking along the roadside late at night, too late, really, for a 17-year-old to be out alone, even in a town as safe as this. And it is raining. The first rain of the season. The streets slick with a fine, immiscible glaze of water and petrochemicals, so that even a driver in full possession of her faculties, a driver who hasn't consumed 2 apple martinis and 3 glasses of Hitching Post Pinot Noir before she gets behind the wheel of the car, will have trouble keeping the thing off the sidewalk and out of the gutters, the shrubbery, the highway median, for Christ's sake. But that's not really what I want to talk about, or not yet, anyway. Have you heard of Tunguska in Russia? And then we get into the scientific description of what it was, and then we balance the story back and forth between the absolute facts of our doom in a random universe and the specific family involved in this tragedy.
And what's interesting is that destiny and randomness keep shifting places. That meteor incursion will have been predicted from the beginning of time, and yet we don't know when it will happen. The death of a child wandering in the night, well, it's an every night affair, unfortunately, and keeps parents up way past their bedtimes. And yet in this particular story, the child who is knocked down is carrying someone else's ID because she wants to get into an NC-17 movie and she's only 16.
And so Chicxulub has not come for the narrator miraculously, but it has come for her best friend, Christy Cherwin, that night. And, you know, again, you say that it exemplifies many of the themes I deal with. Again, I'm obsessed with us as animals and intellectuals, people who are able to interpret the universe. But the universe, in the absence of God, remains a cold Darwinian place, and we're at its mercy.
Now, Marilyn Robinson would say, therefore, let's reinstall God, because we can't live without it. It's too cold, too devastating.
As Kierkegaard before had said.
But your stories seem to trace some kind of trajectory of acceptance that there is no release, there's no consolation, there's only this moment, this story. If it ends happily, well and good, the next one may not, and the next moment might bring everything crashing down upon one's head. Can you live that way? Do you feel safe?
No, I don't. I feel utterly eaten up with misery. Samuel Beckett was probably a joyful man compared to me, but art sustains me. As you know, and as this preface says, I grew up in New York in a mainly Jewish community. Most of my lifelong best friends are Jews who are not observant, you know, wise guys. We were all wise guys together. I was Catholic until about 11 or 12 or so, and I said to my mother, this is preposterous. You know, I'm studying earth science. To her credit, she said, all right. The next thing I knew, I was 17 years old at college and reading the existentialists. Thank God, the absurdist playwrights at the same time. And those are the two poles I've had to avoid colliding with my whole life. And I write in order to sort these things out. Who are we? Why are we? Why does it matter? Why do we invent God? Why do we invent voodoo? Are we lucky today or are we not? We're lucky, the two of us, given the odds, just to be sitting here alive at this moment, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I think that to be able to go home and read a book before going to bed is one of the blessings that the universe can confer. Almost too generous in our cases.
And yet, in both our cases, until we were, let's say, mature, of maybe into our 30s, we were out there every night banging our heads up against the universe just to see what it could do to us. My mother would wait for me. I was a teenager. I was out doing things, speeding in the car at 100, being drunk and so on. She would wait for me, as I point out in one of these stories, to come home. One night I came home at 4 in the morning. There's a cigarette glowing in the dark. It's my mother. I said, what are you doing? She said, I was worried about you. What a preposterous concept. Worried about me? Nothing could ever happen to me.
I know. My parents used to stage incursions where they'd wait in the dark. I'd come home, turn on the bedroom light, and there they would be, my mother and father sitting there in the darkness. Where were you?
Again, we referenced Woody Allen earlier. This is like from one of his movies.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with T.C. Boyle about his book, T.C. Boyle Stories 2. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with T.C. Boyle about his latest book, T.C. Boyle Stories 2, a mammoth collection of short fiction from a master who likes to write about what you don't know. Now, I wanted to say that at the end of the very last story in this book, which I assume is the most recent story, a young man, a boy, has just rocked up his life grandly. It's his destiny, in a sense. He's moved from an unheated chicken coop to house it in a very nice place with a lake and a pool table, a beautiful girlfriend who's finally gotten a job and is bringing in some of the money, too. And he brags about her and acts indifferently about her in a bar and brings the stranger the orbit of the story.
This is a somewhat autobiographical story, as I point out in the preface. And yet, this didn't happen in exactly this way, of course, because that's not what fiction does. But it is one of the most recent. But I chose this one to end because of the final paragraph.
Exactly.
He is cast out from the house because here is the stranger he's invited in, and whatever's going to happen between him and the girlfriend, he doesn't want to know. It's freezing. The lake is now frozen. Summer is gone. The golden days are gone. And he walks across the lake attracted by a light on the other side. And there is a couple in there, and he is peeping on them in a way in which he's trying to understand what a relationship is, how people can live together. Shall I quote this?
It's perfect. Let's read it. It's beautiful.
Let me just quote the very end of that story.
The story, by the way, is called Burnham Wood.
Yes. Yes. What I saw was an ordinary room, a bedroom, lit like a stage. I saw a bed, an armoire, pictures on the wall. A shadow flickered across the room, then another. But for the longest time, I didn't see anything. And then the man came into view, padding back and forth, undressing, getting ready for bed. How old was he? I couldn't tell, not really. Older than me, but not old. He settled into the bed, a double bed, queen size maybe, flicked on the lamp there and picked up a magazine and began reading. At some point, he set it down and seemed to be saying something to the other person in the room, the wife, I guessed. But of course it was just a murmur to me. And then, as if she'd heard her cue and stepped out of the wings, there she was, in a nightgown, fussing around her side of the bed before finally settling in and turning on her own light. I felt guilty. I felt sick. And I didn't see anything revealing, or sexual, that is. No snuggling, or stroking, or even a kiss. They were night owls, those people. That light burned a long time. I know, because I stayed there till it went out.
For me, it's a story of a miscreant who leaves a scene of sort of, well, what's about to happen? Rape? Consensual rape? Something awful for him. He walks across an icy lake to get a look at normalcy.
Exactly.
And he yearns for it. And you can see, because he stays until the light goes out and tells us that the light didn't go out right away, that he is really having to think about what he's been, what he is, and what he wants. You know, never easy, a heartbreaking process.
I think this is what a good story can do for us. I think of some of Raymond Carver's stories in the way that he gives us a sort of powerful elliptical ending like this and draws you back into the story to reassess the character and what he's thinking. And in this case, to my mind, there's also an element of growing up, of looking for maturity. How do you behave as an adult? We don't know. It's not programmed. It's something we have to discover, and maybe we make missteps.
Yes, and I think the stories in the last quarter of the book more and more are investigating the possibilities of maturity, and they have an odd beauty about them because they are saying, oh, even though I, T.C. Boyle, make sure that my hair looks the way it looked 25 years ago, I'm wearing a very hip T-shirt and a black leather jacket, I am now writing stories that are looking at around the corner at that side where things are settling down.
Even further, Michael.
Yeah.
As we're on the subject. There's a story in here called Slate Mountain.
Yes.
About old people. In the Sierra Club on a hike, two of them get separated and spend the night together up there. You know, I was an apprentice adult at the time of a story like Burnham Wood. It's basic incidents that occurred in my life. Well, now, an apprentice elderly person. I mean, there's no guidebook for being elderly. And here I am, creeping along, wondering what it's going to be like. It's a period of adjustment. I'm a neophyte.
When you started out, you were, you know, everyone knew it, the king of the Iowa writing program, the person who brought in more stories, more effectively completed, you know, like a fisherman who could just pull them up out of the lake, out of the stream, out of the river. I don't fish.
There were many, many gifted writers in my time there. I was there for 5.5 years because I also did my PhD there. I was writing and publishing stories as a student. In fact, my first book, Descent of Man, in 1979, collected 17 of the 30 or so stories I'd published as a student. The others remain in the mists of history. From then on, though, I felt that now I'm a maturing writer, and everything that I'm doing will be part of my life's work.
Now, though, I would say the majority, at least of American writers, are coming from writing programs. Do you still like them? Do you like what you see coming from them?
I see a lot of prejudice against them and have, since I was old enough to talk, I guess, and I have to explain this to the Europeans all the time as well, especially. Again, I think of it in this way. we have always had graphic arts in the university. We've also had music in the university. So why shouldn't we have the literary arts as well? I've never had a problem with that. People have a misapprehension. They think that you can take someone off the street, bring them into a class, and make them into a great artist. Well, that is not going to happen. But I have been so impressed by the amazing level of genetic talent that I see in my students and always have. These are people who, like me, are trying to discover that talent. Some have become quite well-known writers. Others, you know, are sitting on Santa Monica Boulevard with a very creative sign begging for change. I can't predict that. All I can do is nurture, encourage, and be a stern taskmaster with regard to structure and grammar and so on.
Well, T.C. Boyle has, over the years, turned many student writers onto things they never could have dreamed of.
And they're exactly like us. They love books. They love literature. They want to produce art. I'm not teaching them anything except perhaps by example or turning them onto things. I'm just giving them an ear. Here it is. I appreciate it. I'm reading it with respect.
Well, you're giving them an ear, but also a pile of, well, 1,900 pages of short stories and enough information to say this can become a life well lived. Yeah?
I agree, and it's been my life. It's what redeemed me from my errant youth. It sounds Dickensian. We talked of Dickens, but it is true. I was going in the wrong direction, and the desire to make art and the ability to do it and the feedback I got enabled me to become what I am today. And, of course, some would say, well, that's too bad. You're a monster. I can't help it. Art is what I live for.
I've been talking with T.C. Boyle, author of T.C. Boyle Stories 2, published by Viking. Thank you, Tom, again for joining me.
You're welcome.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ian Lee is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.